Schizophrenia, Ellen Sachs writes, rolls in like a fog, becoming imperceptibly thicker as time goes on. Sachs is a professor of law, psychology, and psychiatry in the behavioral sciences, and she's written widely on mental health and the law. But her knowledge of schizophrenia is deep and personal. Though many of her colleagues and students are just now learning it, Sachs herself suffers from the disease. It emerged when she was in college and strengthened in graduate school. She suffered serious episodes of delusions and paranoia, at times mumbling to herself in hallways and forgetting to eat and bathe. Remarkably, despite several hospitalizations, Sachs managed to graduate as class valedictorian at Vanderbilt and complete studies at Oxford and Yale Law School. She's told her story in a new memoir. It's called The Center Cannot Hold, My Journey Through Madness. Well, Ellen Sachs, welcome to Fresh Air. Schizophrenia typically presents itself, I guess, in early adulthood, I guess often a little earlier with men than women. Mm-hmm. As you reflect on your childhood, are there mm-hmm. moments that you think might have been early manifestations of your illness?
You know, I had a bunch of symptoms when I was growing up. I think a lot of them were within normal limits. You know, I was fearful. I had some phobias. I had some obsessions. I had some kind of intense fears that in retrospect might have been a kind of beginning of the illness poking through. But the first real clear sign of it was when I was 15 or 16. And I started walking home from school precipitously. I just suddenly got up and walked home. And I felt as if the houses were sending me messages and getting all weird and frightening, and I was terrified. So that was kind of the first episode, but I brought it to an end fairly quickly, and it didn't come back in that kind of florid form until I went to Oxford as a graduate student.
What did you make of it at the time?
I didn't know what to make of it. It was just something that happened to me. It was weird. I was worried about it. In retrospect, I wish I would have gotten some good treatment at the time. My parents were very good parents and very kind and caring parents, but I don't think they really understood that I needed treatment for the things that I was experiencing. Who knows if it would have made a difference, but maybe it would have.
There's a moment you described when you were 8 years old. You ask your dad if you can go out to the cabana for a swim.
Right.
Describe what happened then.
Basically, I asked my dad if we could go out to the cabana for a swim, and he kind of snapped at me and said he had work to do, and didn't he already tell me that it might rain and it wouldn't be a good idea to go? And at that moment, my heart sinks. I've disappointed my dad, but then something else happens that is a little bit, I think, out of the ordinary and people don't really understand, which is kind of my self-dissolving. It's sort of consciousness gradually losing its coherence. It was my first experience. Actually, probably I should say this is the first experience, but it was the first experience I had of what I call disorganization. And imagine a sandcastle with the sand starting to slide away. That's what it's like. It's like your center, yourself, starts gradually disappearing, falling apart. There's no one there, as it were, to take in sensations and thoughts and ideas and put them together. You're just falling apart. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying because without a kind of sturdy vantage point or without a self, you know, you're very disabled, to say the least.
And
it was obviously very scary.
And reflecting back decades later, you remember that moment when you were only eight.
Something about it is very vivid
to you, right?
Yes, it was. Yeah. And it's something that defines what happens when I get ill now. It's one of the things that happened. I get what I call disorganized, and I'm not able to hold things together or stay focused or say the solid.
There are a few points in the book where you describe in really vivid detail what your psychotic episodes look like, particularly to others. And I was going to ask you to read one of these. This is one, actually, you begin the book with this, because I think maybe because it's such a great example, although it chronologically comes later when you're at Yale Law School. If you would just kind of set this up and read this section for us.
Okay, sure. So this is the beginning of the prologue, starting now. It's 10 o'clock on a Friday night. I am sitting with my two classmates in the Yale Law School library. They aren't too happy about being here. It's a weekend, after all. There are plenty of other fun things they could be doing. But I'm determined that we hold our small group meeting. We have a memo assignment. We have to do it. Have to finish it. Have to produce it. Have to... Wait a minute. No, wait. Memos are visitations, I announce. They make certain points. The point is on your head. Have you ever killed anyone? My study partners look at me as if they or I have been splashed with ice water. "This is a joke, right?" one asks. "What are you talking about, Ellen?" asks the other. "Oh, the usual. Heaven and hell. Who's what? What's who? Hey," I say, leaping out of my chair. "Let's go out on the roof." I practically sprint to the nearest large window, climb through it, and step out onto the roof, followed a few moments later by my reluctant partners in crime. "This is the real me," I announce, my arms waving above my head. "Come to the Florida lemon tree. Come to the Florida sunshine bush, where they make lemons, where there are demons. Hey, what's the matter with you guys?" "You're frightening me," one blurts out. A few uncertain moments later, "I'm going back inside," says the other. They look scared. Have they seen a ghost or something? And hey, wait a minute, they're scrambling back through the window. "Why are you going back in?" I ask, but they're already inside and I'm alone. A few minutes later, somewhat reluctantly, I climb back through the window too. Once we're all seated around the table again, I carefully stack my textbooks into a small tower, then rearrange my note pages. Then I rearrange them again. I can see the problem, but I can't see its solution. This is very worrisome. "I don't know if you're having the same experience of words jumping around the pages as I am," I say. "I think someone's infiltrated my copies of the cases. We've got to case the joint, but I don't believe in joints. But they do hold your body together." I glance up from my papers to see my two colleagues staring at me. I have to go," says one. "Me too," says the other. They seem nervous as they hurriedly pack up their stuff and leave, with a vague promise about catching up with me later and working on the memo then.
And that's from the beginning of the book, The Center Cannot Hold. It's by our guest, Ellen Sachs, about her battle with schizophrenia. You know, that's such a vivid description. And those monologues that you go into where there are these weird associations about, you know, points and all that. How did you reconstruct those for the book?
You know, it's kind of interesting because people ask me, how could I possibly remember? But I remember the same way that everyone who writes a memoir remembers. You try to think back to what you were thinking and feeling and, you know, capture it as best you can. There are certainly occasions in the book where I know on this particular day, in this particular episode, I had this particular delusion, like my therapist and my best friend Steve Behnke were taken over by aliens. And then there are other times where I say, I was feeling such and such, and, you know, this is the kind of thought I tend to have when I'm feeling such and such, such as I've killed hundreds of thousands of people with my thoughts. But some people with psychotic episodes don't remember their episodes, and I'm not one of those people. I do remember. So I'm basically in the same position that anyone is in who's trying to faithfully recount their thoughts and feelings at some time in the past.
Is it a burden to have all those memories?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I think it's part of my history. It's part of who I am. It's part of what makes me who I am. And so I wouldn't want to lose the memories. I actually have had some physical health problems, so I had a subarachnoid hemorrhage, a stroke, and after that I stopped being able to remember dreams. And my dreams had been very disturbing and really more nightmares than dreams, but I regret that I don't have that kind of window into my soul anymore, probably as a result of the bleed. And that's the case even though those dreams were sometimes horrifying and scary as anything.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, of course, is that one of the problems with schizophrenia is that when people begin to get ill, they don't realize they're getting ill. They think they're understanding reality as it is, when in fact it's quite distorted. And I'm wondering if your ability to remember your previous episodes was ever a tool that you could say, wait a minute, I recognize this thought pattern. This is what I do when I get sick.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, a psychosis is not like an on-off button, but a kind of a dimmer switch, and it ranges in degrees of intensity. And by this time, I know my illness fairly well, and it's not uncommon for me to have a kind of transient psychotic thought and say, oh, that's just my illness acting up. And one thing that stood me in good stead is even when it gets worse, even when I am really, really believing the crazy things, I always know that other people will think they're crazy, and I'm motivated to not appear crazy, so I'm able to kind of make my way in the world in that way. And then occasions where it's just so intense and so profound, I just know not to be around people because I don't know what I'll say. So for the most part, I can control what I say, even though I really can't control what I think.
When you were at Oxford, you had this really important relationship with this psychiatrist, Dr. Elizabeth Jones. And one of the things that's interesting about this part of the story is that I think we tend to think of effective treatment for schizophrenia as being antipsychotic medications. But this, she was a psychoanalyst, and what you really did was talk therapy. So tell us about that relationship and that treatment.
Yeah. It's often said that people with schizophrenia don't benefit from psychoanalysis or psychoanalytic psychotherapy. And for me, that's been one of the key parts of my my treatment and my recovery, or my being recovering, so to speak. I still have symptoms sometimes. But how did psychoanalysis work for me? Well, that's always a $60,000 question. How does it work? And two possibilities, and I think they're both active in my case, are insight and the relationship. And I think what psychoanalysis helped me with is, first of all, identifying and coping with stress, because stress is bad for all illnesses, especially mental illness. It helped me come to terms with having an illness and needing treatment. That's a kind of blow to your self-esteem, if I can put it that way. It gave me a place where I can talk about the things that were haunting me and troubling me and scaring me. It detoxified symptoms by interpreting them. You know, I think you're saying such and such because you're jealous or fearful or whatever. And it made it more meaningful and easier to cope with. And then the relationship with the kind, non-judgmental, tolerant person who accepts everything in you, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and stays strong, kind of contains you and holds you together. So I think all of those things helped.
And were you taking antipsychotic medications when you were seeing Dr. Jones?
I did not take any medicine when I was seeing her.
Right. Later in your story, when you're with different, you're in different care and you're given antipsychotic drugs, and there are moments when you get ill and you take larger doses, and the effect is immediate. It brings the psychosis under control. Did sessions with these talking sessions with Dr. Jones, did they have the same kind of immediate effect of reducing and easing your psychotic symptoms?
They could reduce and ease them. They could not get rid of them. I don't believe that psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, anything can really control the symptoms of delusions and hallucinations and things like that. They can make them less. They can make them so that you can live your life even in the face of having them. But I firmly believe at this point, after many years of struggling against the idea that the antipsychotics are also an essential part of the picture, and that I'm much better off on the antipsychotics than off them. For me, Mrs. Jones, in a way, kind of interrupted the more malignant, what they call negative symptoms of schizophrenia, inability to do work and inability to socialize and have friends. Once I got into treatment with her, all that, which had been gone for 2 years while I was becoming schizophrenic, so to speak, went away. And I was able to have friends and be able to work and things like that. But the delusions and hallucinations, every once in a while an interpretation would make one go away. But in order to make it really go away, I need medication as well. But again, that's not enough. Particularly all those years when I was taking medications that were less good than the ones that I'm on today.
Mm-hmm.
That's to say, I was always kind of on the edge and could go either way, and having the therapy kept me on the right side of the line most of the time.
You know, an inspiring part of this book is the fact that you, despite your illness, completed law school at Yale, and after a stint as a legal services lawyer, became a law professor at USC and went on and got psychoanalytic training and have written books and articles and have a distinguished academic career as a legal scholar. How much do people know about your illness now, and how much are they going to be learning as they read this book and hear these interviews?
You need to proceed cautiously. It's sort of another dilemma for psychiatric patients, because the way people deal with trauma is by talking about it, but this is something that it's hard to talk about with people, especially in the beginning. I've been very fortunate that I've had close friends and my husband who really know me well and helped me. My friend Steve, who I went to law school with and who became a clinical psychologist and is now director of ethics at the APA, we're like dear, dear friends. He knows me as well as anybody knows me. We speak on the phone almost every day, and he can sometimes tell when I'm starting to lose it before I can. So having friends who know and understand is extremely important. It's not only true for psychiatric patients, it's for everybody. Everybody needs someone that they can talk to, or some people that they can talk to and turn to. But then I've had weird experiences. I remember in law school, I disclosed to one of my classmates that I had had this illness and that I had the breakdown and was on the roof of the Yale Law School and made a belt out of television wire. And she said, oh, do you still feel like making belts? Like, totally not getting what the thing is like.
Right.
And then there, you know, there are times, I remember I was writing my article on restraints, and one of the professors at Yale, a psychiatrist, I was talking about how, putting it onto the third person, how it must be so degrading and painful. And he looked at me, he said, "Ellen, those people are psychotic. They're not like you and me. They have different experiences." And I so wanted to say, well, yeah, they are like me. But, you know, you have to be careful. You have to be cautious.
Well, before writing this book, did your colleagues at the law school, did students at the law school know that you, you know, had been hospitalized as a schizophrenic?
No. None of my students, at this point, one person knows. But probably like my second or third year, I told my closest friends. And then, you know, over time told more people. Once the book was about, you know, was definitely being published, I started telling more and more people. So I'd say at this point, you know, maybe three quarters of the faculty and staff know. In fact, the book has been passed around among the staff a lot, which is kind of a kick.
Apart from staying on your medications, what restrictions does your illness place on your life today?
You know, it does place restrictions. It's easy to be overstimulated, as we were discussing, so I try to manage things by having a very kind of strict regimen or strict routine that I follow and try to keep change to a minimum, stimulation to a minimum. There are times when I need to be alone, I always need some alone time. You know, some of this can be difficult for people close to me, like my husband loves to travel, but I find it difficult, and so we just kind of negotiate it and do the best that we can. It's also the case that I'm very vulnerable to stress. So, you know, bad medical news or bad this news or that news, I know there are times that I sometimes just kind of shut down and withdraw a bit from life. So that's another kind of limitation. It's one of the things that makes me work as hard as I do, because I know there'll be down times. But for the most part, I feel pretty well and pretty happy. And
you wrote that there were points in your life and treatment where you were on, you know, doses of medications that kept the symptoms under control, but you could still feel these forces, these demons sort of out there, that you were just sort of keeping them at bay.
Right.
Are they still there? Do you feel them?
No, you know, the new medications, I can't say they're not there completely. I have what they call breakthrough symptoms, transient symptoms. You know, probably not a week goes by that I don't have a thought or two like that, but I just dismiss them. But for the most part, I mean, when I was on the older medications, it was like I was having to lean against the door to keep the demons from breaking through. And now I mostly feel fine. And even though I can get symptomatic, it's less often, it's less long-lasting, it's less intense, easier to bring to a close. And most of the time, I feel anything different from what anybody else feels. You know, I have the usual, you know, anxiety and concerns and, you know, worried about health or sad about this, but not really the demons banging on the door to get out. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying because without a kind of sturdy vantage point or without a self, you know, you're very disabled, to say the least.
How long has it been since you've had what you would call a real psychotic break?
Gosh, if we're talking about a couple of days, I guess within the month, I had a couple of days when I was out of the office. I needed to be out of the office, and by the end of the second day, I was symptomatic. If we're talking about like a week or more, it's been since like 2000, 2001 when I was trying to change medications.
And when you had it for a couple of days, what kinds of things were you experiencing?
I just felt like I was, there were people who wanted to hurt me and kill me, and maybe I had killed other people, and I was being attacked, and my thoughts got disjointed and confused and, you know, that kind of thing.
And then when that happened, what was your response?
Basically, I called my therapist and my psychiatrist, and I went up on my meds a bit and got things back under control within a fairly short time, a day or two.
Well, it's a great book, and I really wish you the best. Ellen Sachs, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed speaking.
USC Professor of Law and Psychology Ellen Sachs. Many of her colleagues will learn more of her illness when she speaks at the American Psychological Association convention in San Francisco later this month. Her memoir is called The Center Cannot Hold: My Journey Through Madness.